This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Ledette Randolph. She's the author of a memoir called Leaving the Pink House. How are you, Ledette?
Hi, I'm fine. Thanks, David.
This is a wonderful book. I really liked it a lot.
Thank you.
And I really love the cover, by the way.
Thanks. That's actually our property, or our old property.
Right. It's a green space with a lot of relatively low-lying trees. There's no way to actually know that the picture was taken in Nebraska, but that's where your house was. The house that you are leaving in the book is actually in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yes.
But the house that you were leaving, the pink house, to go build was outside of Lincoln. 20 miles, is that right?
Yeah, about 20 miles. That's a good estimate.
And the structure, I mean, I know that there's a kind of genre of memoir that has to do with house building and house remodeling. And of course, there are television shows that have to do with this subject too. But you really used this form in a different way, I think. You used this to, or house is more the grounding of your story. It's not just about one house or a second house. It's really you having this, going through this period of disruption in your life. You use the memoir to tell the story of your life in houses.
Yes.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about how you came to see that as a structure that would work for you.
Well, I wish I could say that I conceived of the structure and then sort of, approached the story. But actually what happened is that I had two different projects going. I had written many years before the house construction that I describe in this book. I had written a series of essays that I never really intended for publication. They were just essays that were kind of trying to help me understand what had been a kind of difficult, especially early adult life. And Then I wrote this story, and it grew out of journals that I kept during this renovation. And neither of those projects ever really stood alone. And then I began to realize that the essays often centered on memories around a house, that was how I had kind of organized my memories. And so when I put them together, and of course I left out many, many of the essays that I had written, when I put them together, then I felt like I was doing something that was a little meatier than what either one alone would have done. And so I guess really the gutting and rebuilding of the house becomes a kind of structuring metaphor for a life that is gutted and rebuilt. And that's maybe being kind of dramatic, but that's how I began to conceive of it.
Right. Well, in fact, as you tell, you alternate the chapters so that one chapter is memory and one chapter is present.
Right.
And you do so then through the telling of your life story in all of the houses that you lived in when you were growing up and into your adulthood, you then tell that story of your life and how you became who you are.
Yes.
I can't say that you had an unusual childhood because I don't know really whether that's right. I mean, you did have a difficult childhood.
I think I had a very happy childhood. I think I had a loving and supportive family. And I think that, I certainly can't claim that I had a difficult childhood. I think what happened for me was a sense of the disruption in our life when my father decided that he wanted something more and really didn't know how to find that. And so that kind of, following him around, and trying to realize these dreams of his that sadly, I think, never really came to fruition. And so, and then I think, too, that a lot of what I'm describing in this book is about a kind of fundamentalist childhood. which isn't all bad, you know, but also it becomes something that I have to think my way through and get past. And then when bad things happen, when you're in the process of trying to leave a worldview that is very absorbing, very all-encompassing, at least for me it was, and then bad things happen, it becomes the only way you know how to solve problems. So I felt that that was the story, that I kept sort of not being able to figure out what I really wanted because of this kind of back and forth, this competing way of thinking. And so that, for me, that's a kind of, if there's an overarching narrative here, I think it's that, about leaving that worldview.
Right. Well, you talked about, I mean, it is, you know, for many people maybe who don't have the experience of a, you know, fundamentalist or structured religious childhood, you know, that was very striking. And that was that you talked about the, and as you just sort of alluded to, the comfort of that is a form of problem solving. And of course, you know, some of us are more, some people feel that that's the attraction, but also the problem with that kind of structure, because it does enable, it gives you comfort, but it doesn't, then that comfort maybe prevents you from grappling and from seeing what you are in the, you know, in that space. Although if you're in that space, you don't feel that way.
Right. Well, there's a kind of, you know, there's a comfort. There are these sort of answers for a lot of life's mysteries. And so there's a kind of anti-intellectual component here. And that's not to say at all that you know, everyone who's a practitioner is anti-intellectual. But, you know, for especially a child, I think, or the kind of child I was, that was certainly a component. And then also there's a fearfulness, or there was for me, of transgressing, of leaving, you know, and there are lots of ways that there's a kind of script for not following your own dreams, you know, but always keeping that in check, because you have a higher order to follow. And so, you know, it's really, there's a kind of battle. There's a real battle going on. And so, you know, that's what I say. I spent my 20s raising kids and then fighting, you know, really thinking of my way out of this kind of worldview.
Did you feel that when you were doing that, that you were at risk in some way?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I mentioned that in one of the pieces, you know, this thing, you know, you looking back, you know, of course, you feel like an idiot for thinking this way. But when you're in the midst of it, it's not that easy. And I didn't have a lot of acquaintances outside. So there's also a kind of, you know, there's a weird kind of isolation that's going on. And so, you know, I was thinking these strange things. So,
well, and you, but you also, you did have, I think the one thing I think of, it's, I guess it's probably, it must be difficult for you. And that is when you were first married, your first husband was killed in an accident so soon after you were married.
Yeah.
That must have been, I mean, was that, well, I don't know. It was that experience. It seemed to take you back to where you had been.
Absolutely. I really didn't, I was 20. I just turned 20, and I really did not know how to grieve. And, you know, there wasn't a kind of, opportunity or searching out of, any kind of counseling or anything that might have helped me think through that. And, you know, I think it's not really a surprise that as I've come to look back at least my two novels that I've published, that the theme, the obsession, is really about improper grieving And I didn't realize it until they were, you know, till far after I published them and read them and thought about it and realized that's what I was working out there. And I didn't know how to handle that. And pitched me right back into the faith community. So,
but I didn't feel in this book that you were judgmental toward the people who you grew up with, who had that faith, who were, it didn't feel like you were feeling a rejecting of them even.
Oh, I'm glad you say that, because that's absolutely true. I don't. I mean, my family, my mother is still very much in that world, and other family members, and I adore them, you know, and they're wonderful people. They're not crazy. They're not bad people. I certainly don't feel like I had a bad childhood. And I still have many friends, you know, in that community. So I'm very glad to hear that it doesn't sound judgmental. I certainly don't mean it to be that way.
No, but it is also true that, there is a kind of different, there's such a different worldview between people. I mean, you were involved while you were writing this book, and before then you've been at the University of Nebraska Press.
Right.
So you're in a world that's, you know, well, I mean, it's not that there's a conflict between religiosity and fundamentalism and university life, but there are many people in the universities who are not comfortable with fundamentalist belief systems.
Right. And there certainly are fundamentalists who are scholars, and, you know, there certainly are, they're there. I left it far behind. I was very far away from it. And, and in a way, I think it is, the part of the story really is about making peace with that past, not apologizing for it. I think that the bit I wrote about going to a black church for 5 years and in that process, you know, thinking my way out of it, that was a very, actually, strangely, a healing thing for me, because I could just leave in a kind of gentle way and not in an angry way, which I think is how a lot of people leave that kind of faith community.
That's true. Although I think there are people who find a way to reconcile.
Oh, yeah. I'm
trying to remember the name of this book. Unfortunately, I can't, because it was a few years ago. But I read a book and interviewed the author it was about her story growing up in rural North Dakota. Mm-hmm. As a gay woman who did not really even know she was gay, you know, I mean, she knew she was gay, but she didn't have a context for being gay in the Christian fundamentalist tradition that she grew up in.
Right.
And so she talked a lot about her fears and, you know, trying to figure out how to talk to people about who she is, and, you know, ended up moving to Minneapolis. But then the book was about going back and being who she is, and mm-hmm. not, you know, no longer being in that tradition or in that faith and in that community, but finding out that she was in fact accepted for who she is, and never realized that that was possible when she was younger. So there was there is a reconciliation, but there's still a gulf of understanding between the two different worldviews.
Right. And you know, I think you come to something else here, which is not only about leaving a kind of maybe too restrictive faith, but also I think when those of us who grow up in especially maybe the Great Plains, you know, or the Midwest, and feel that there's something there that is restrictive to us. And there are many, many people, there's a huge, you know, diaspora of people who have felt they had to leave their small towns and isolated parts of the country to go to cities, to, you know, whatever, to have careers. And then realizing, for some of us, you know, going back and realizing that there's still a place there for us, or that we maybe there are things to love there. And I think for me, because my development was so different from so many of my peers who left at 18, went away to college and never came back. I stayed and I built a career and a kind of, you know, amazing good luck of a career in Nebraska and never left. And all the time was so puzzled that I didn't leave and couldn't leave. So I had to stay and make that peace and reconcile, as you say, is by growing in place. And I think that's a very different journey than leaving and finding yourself somewhere else.
Well, that's true. And of course, there's so many people in America who grow up in one place and then end up living in another.
Yeah.
That in the 20th, late 20th and early 21st century, that is very much the American lifestyle. Or
right.
Life way, you might call it, and it is more unusual. Not completely. I mean, it's not like everybody moves, but it's so common that it does feel different when you come to someone who is more. And there, you know, you sort of. I've always thought about this. There are two different ways of knowing. One is the kind of go out and see as many places as you possibly can, but not know any of them really well.
Yeah.
And then there's the other way, which is to stay in one place and be really rooted and know it completely.
Right.
And both ways are valid. I don't think one is better than the other necessarily, but I think in modern America, because there are fewer people who stay in one place, in some ways it is more valuable because that experience is different from what so many people take for granted.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that. I think that, you know, the prevailing sentiment is that if you don't leave, it's a snobbishness, you know, let's be honest about it. Oh, how can you stay there? You know,
right,
why
right.
are you staying there? You must not be able to get out.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's something that also, I don't know if I address it a lot in this book, but it's definitely something that I'm aware of. As someone coming from a state that is often, you know, maybe not represented very well in the, you know, national psyche or, you know, the mental maps of people. And, you know, there you internalize that as a young person. I knew that and I knew nothing, but I knew that as a very young child that we were sort of not that special. We were not considered great.
You're not part of the bigger culture in the right. vital way that the bigger culture presents itself
right.
as being. So you're in, you know, Nebraska, I would say Nebraska, Kansas, the Dakotas.
Yep. The Great Plains.
Right. And also parts of the South have had that same complexion, shall we call it, you know, that in the compared to the culture of modern mass culture that you see on television or that's represented in magazines, those states don't have as big a place.
Right. We're marginalized from the dominant culture. And so, you know, but it's very interesting how quickly, you know, a child can grasp that's their experience. And so, you know, that all is an element in kind of finding your identity. And I often think, too, now that I live in Boston and I'm on the subways all the time and, you know, you're surrounded by not only people, you're surrounded by text. If your family was very isolated, if you, you know, there was a certain kind of limitation in your schooling, but you're on this subway, you're looking at all of these signs, you're looking at all of these other options, you're seeing people reading, you're seeing people doing something other. And I think that always strikes me that if I had been a child exposed to even just a little bit of that, it would have been like a lifeline for me. And that was not there.
Well, do you think that's partly because of the rural isolation that occurs in some of, you know, in places like Nebraska where, you know, their communities are smaller, there is no public transportation, the library and the schools are the only kind of public
right.
Public venue for that kind of communication?
Well, I think that I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, because there's a lot of there are variables here. That my growing up in a farmhouse on the edge of the Sandhills, not seeing a library, a real library, until I was 12, that's a very different experience than the experience that my children had growing up in Lincoln, where you have very progressive high schools. Not all of them are progressive, but, you know, my kids went to a fantastic high school. There were 70 languages spoken there. It was a resettlement community for immigrants. There were out gay teachers there. There, you know, amazing school. And that's still Nebraska, but it wasn't my experience growing up. So I think that, it's really looking back at my particular experience of a kind of isolation.
Right. Well, let's switch slightly, because we've talked so much about your growing up part, but we haven't really talked about the house.
Yeah.
And the two houses. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about both the Pink House, which was, you know, at one point really your dream house there in the middle of Lincoln, you know, in a really nice, well, in a neighborhood that you really liked, and that you and your husband had put time and energy into making your own. And then you have this sort of impulsive moment influenced by some outside factors, including 9/11 in 2001. And so, you know, we don't need to repeat everything that you talk about in the book about this, but you end up with this farmhouse that you have to remodel on a short schedule because you've taken a bridge loan.
Right.
So you have a deadline. You have to work on the house. Then you also have to get your old house ready to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And you have all the emotional impact of leaving one place that you really like and having to go through that selling process, which is really painful.
Right.
And then you have, at the same time, the difficulties, let's say, and the challenges of basically gutting a house and rebuilding it from the ground up, knowing that you're going to run into just terrible problems that you couldn't anticipate that might upset your schedule. So the stress level on both sides is really high. You're leaving a beautiful place that you like, and you're going to a place which has to be built, and you're building it yourself, which is with, you know, friends and family, but still it's pretty intense.
Yeah. Well, my husband is really kind of the hero of this book, right? I mean, he's the guy who does this work, and also, you know, he's charming, and, you know, people love him, and many people come and help, and you know, it's just it becomes a very humbling experience for us, because we do realize that we've taken on this enormous project. And it's crazy. I think we were like temporarily insane. it's just hard to describe kind of what we were thinking. But you've captured a lot of the mood of the book. And obviously, Noel's my husband, we're kind of at cross purposes here. I'm seeing the end of raising children. You know, I've spent 20 some years raising kids and going to school and kind of, you know, looking forward to these freedom, and our house is done, and we've spent years renovating the Pink House, and I love it, and I'm so happy, and I'm thinking about, you know, oh, now we can do something else with our time and money. And then we take on this big project, and it changes how I'm going to see my life post children. And, you know, I'm no longer going to be that person that lives near downtown and can walk to a movie, you know, in the evening. I'm going to be driving everywhere, and I'm not excited about it. So, you know, it's to say the least. Yeah, it's not just the house. It's a lifestyle that I'm not excited about. because 9/11 happens in the middle of this 3-day negotiation, that is why I said I felt like I was kind of temporarily insane. I was already wondering why I was going along with this. And then that happened, and it really was so unsettling to me, and so, it, you know, so irrational that, you know, we were really going to be affected in any way. But, you know, you just... I kind of had that moment, and just happened to be in that moment we were making this decision about the, buying this house. So,
yeah, I think looking at it from the outside, which I can be, I thought you were crazy, but
yeah, you know,
and you know, but you did a really good job of, you know, at least for the reader, of not over dramatizing that. I mean, you were pretty reasonable in the way that you wrote this. It's you could have written it as a level of, you know, a couple of notches higher. So I think that it's good that you actually managed the emotion in the writing to prevent it from being like a television drama or something. But still, you get across, you know, the intensity of it and the difficulty. And of course, then there's the reward. You do succeed.
Yeah.
You amazingly sell your old house fairly quickly to friends, which is, I think, a good thing.
Yes.
And then you move into the new house. Mm-hmm. Now, it's necessary to ask because we know, you know, I know that you are no longer in Nebraska. Now you're the editor of Plowshares Magazine in Massachusetts, in Boston. And so you must have... you've disrupted yourselves, you and your husband, one more time.
Yes.
Did you sell the house in Nebraska, or were you able to keep it?
We did sell it. I took this job and actually lived here for a couple of years alone. And we were doing the long distance thing because we were debating this, you know, would we maybe just want to, you know, keep that house and eventually move back there. And then that really was not sustainable. Our marriage, we wanted to be together. And but very, very painful decision. And by then I had fallen deeply in love with that house. And that's the house I miss now. And so, you know, that's the irony of all of this. But our daughter-in-law's parents, our son's wife's parents, bought the house. So We have two little grandkids now who go out, and we hear, you know, they are walking on the paths that we've mowed, and they are spending time by the fire pit, and all of these wonderful things makes us very happy.
It also means you can go back there and visit, and it's part of your family still. So that I think takes some of the sting out of selling something. You know, I'm sure everyone. This must be universally true that, well, maybe there must be exceptions, but that we all probably think of one place in our histories which really has meant the most to us that we really miss.
Yes.
And, you know, I know there, I have a particular, you know, house that I grew up in that for years I used to drive by and see what it looked like anymore. Mm-hmm. And you always have this fantasy of, you know, going and knocking on the door and, seeing and houses I've lived in where people have knocked on the door and said, oh, I grew up here. Can I come in? I just want to see if the backyard looks the same or what's happened to my room.
Yes. Oh, it's very odd. You know, I think you're right. It's a very universal thing. And, you know, in fact, this 2 summers ago when I was working on this book, I was in Lincoln. And of course, I had, you know, kept in touch with my son's in-laws, but they were great about, you know, letting me back out the house. And it was so great to see that they had taken such good care of everything. And then I actually got it back into the pink house, which is still pink. And, you know, it was really, if our friends had moved on and the house had changed quite a bit, but a young couple were living there you know, it was really interesting to do that. So
I think there's another genre of writing, you know, this sort of maybe a personal essay form. I you know, I'm interested in old cars, and I've read a few stories of people finding a car that they loved when they were 25 and it still exists, and it's now an antique and in the hands of somebody else. And In fact, I just read an article, I think it was in the Times, about a really special old car that's still, you know, preserved in its original condition. But it was a race car, I think, that, and they did a story of the guy who originally had the car and then him getting to see it 50 years later. So there must be, I think there's a, as you said before, universality to this idea that these meaningful, you know, you can't call them objects really, but they're more
possessions of some kind.
Yeah, that we just feel. Now, of course, if we were nomadic, maybe we wouldn't have this feeling at all.
Right.
But as you know, because we tend to put a lot of meaning and value into our physical objects, the physical circumstances in which we live, it probably is a really powerful thing.
Well, they become, I think, a kind of extension of our identity. You know, there's some way that they really, I don't know, they tell us who we are, or they confirm something. I don't know. You know, I think that the whole motif of the house is a very interesting one. And I like that you pointed out earlier that, you know, this is a fairly common genre of memoir. You know, houses are meaningful to us and cars.
It's true. Although, again, I think yours stands out because it's not, I mean, there is a lot about the actual building in there, but that's, you know, you've made it, it's transformed. It's not just narrative nonfiction. This, you know, this is how we build a house. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot more, and it's not just the emotion that goes into the building. Mm-hmm. Your book is much more, I think, in that way, much more interesting.
Oh, good. Well, and I'm really glad earlier that you said something about my not kind of writing in a melodramatic way or being overly hyped. And you know, I really, that is a lot of the discipline for me of writing and of writing this particular story, that I did not want to I didn't want to play to a certain kind of, just a certain kind of reading of this, you know, that I did want it to be a little more complex. And so.
Well, I think it is. So yeah. Let me ask you one more question. And that is, having written this book and grounding yourself in the physical, do you have something that you're working on now that's different?
Oh, well, I'm working on a new novel. We'll see if it becomes a novel. I never just write a first draft. I write a zero draft, which is a generative draft. And then I write what I've just started calling the dirty wedding draft, which is, so, you know, I've compiled a lot of paper, or a lot of pages, and I'm, you know, now trying to put together that first draft. And so we'll see if it happens. But this is a story about neighbors. And so we'll see, you know.
Well, so it still has something to do with houses.
Yep. It still has to do with houses.
Well, thank you so much, Lydette. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you, David. It was great to talk to you.
This is Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Lydette Randolph about her book, Leaving the Pink House, a memoir published by the University of Iowa Press. Thanks so much.
Thank you.